Mama, get up. There are people here. They're going to kill us. Mama, we have to run.
Confronting authors with real questions about the writing process, the difficult and disheartening publishing industry, and why anyone would choose to torture themselves in the world of writing, this is the Literally Podcast with your host, writer, runner, and the literary voice of Ogden, Utah, Case Johnston. Exposing literature, the authors, the business, the process, the Literally Podcast.
This is Case Johnston. This is the Literally Podcast. We're at Booked on 25th on historic 25th Street. Today, our guest is Johnny Worthen. Johnny Worthen is an award-winning, best-selling author, voyager, and damn fine human being. I'm guessing he wrote that part. He is the tie-dye-wearing writer of the nationally acclaimed number one Kindle best-selling Eleanor the Unseen. Among his other excellent and very read-worthy titles are the adult occult thriller Beatricel, the award-winning mystery The Brand Demand, and the genre-bending comedy noir The Finger Trap, winner of the Diamond Quill for the best book of the year. And of course, the continuation of the Unseen trilogy with Celeste and David, which have also won awards. Trained in stand-up comedy, modern literary criticism, and cultural studies, Johnny is a frequent public speaker, teacher, and blogger. He's an instructor at the University of Utah and an acquisitions editor for Omnium Gatherum, publisher of unique dark fantasy, weird fiction, and horror. He is currently the president-elect of the League of Utah Writers and last year's Diamond Quill winner for the League of Utah Writers as well. Welcome, Johnny.
The Brand Demand. His normal days began with drinking morning coffee at a local espresso stand. He settled into one not too far from his home, but still one of his favorites. He read the morning newspapers, scanning for new pricks that needed to be taken down a notch. The local section was usually overflowing with homophobic, misogynistic, brain-dead autocrats whose re-education would make the world a better place. It was Utah politics as usual. When he found the rare leader who actually thought about people making less than $100,000 per year, the different or the minority, Galen would find a way to slip him some money for his cause without being noticed. That was the hard part. Galen had to live beneath the radar. He was underground. He went to great pains to keep his wealth and how he got it hidden. The system had all the power and all the cards, and if he came to the attention of those in charge of the system, he'd have little chance. The IRS would ruin his life faster than you could say laundered money. He hadn't the information, the connections, or the funds to ward them off like the corporations the IRS seemed blind to. The FBI, of course, would burn him just as fast and put him away, warehouse him, as they called it, until bell bottoms came back into fashion. He had to choose his targets carefully. If he shot too high, one of his marks could retaliate without even having to come forward. The system protected its own, and Galen was definitely not one of the system's own. Galen's lifestyle was carefully calculated to be mild-mannered and normal. It suited him. He didn't want to make more than he should. He believed in ecology the way other people believed in religion. He had a mild middle-class house and paid taxes on the money he earned from his gambling trips. He drove a sensible car, and Galen had few friends. He had his team, a carefully chosen group of like-minded people who had assembled when his war escalated, and he tried to keep contact with them at a minimum. He was dangerous to know, and he couldn't stomach the idea of jeopardizing them. They had trusted him enough to join his Robin Hood campaign. The least he could do was insulate them from him, and him from them. He knew store owners and activists. He had marched enough times to be recognized as a member of the left, but always, when he showed his face, it was one among hundreds of others. He shopped in local stores, avoided corporate retailers with a zeal that bordered on obsession. The owners all knew his name, his first name, and he'd always paid in cash, and he always shopped alone. This is taken from Eleanor the Unseen. "We got a big day tomorrow, Mom," Eleanor said. "You should get to bed." "I'm not sleepy. I'm going to watch some TV. Keep me company." Now Eleanor knew something was wrong. Tabitha was tired, she knew it. The pills were knocking her mother out, but she didn't press for answers. She felt her mother's reluctance in talking to her about it. Tabitha would tell her when she was ready, Eleanor decided. Okay, Mom, she said, so what's on? Eleanor cuddled with Tabitha on the couch. They watched an old movie with martinis, murder, a cute dog, and long evening dresses. Eleanor felt her mother drift in and out, and then fall asleep outright before the second act. Eleanor watched until the final moment, never guessing who it was until the killer was revealed at a dinner party. The next movie was a B-horror film from the 80s, about a scampering pack of puppets terrorizing a small town. Eleanor switched it off and watched the dying embers in the fireplace. In just a few minutes, she fell asleep, still wrapped in Tabitha's arms. She dreamt poorly. Old memories mixed with new fear, blades, bullets, lies. Murder in the desert, her house on fire, a knife in her side. She dreamt there was a car outside her house. People furtively got out of it and snuck up to her porch. She imagined their footsteps on the path, crunching the wind-blown snow leading to her door. Eleanor snapped awake. Her heart raced. Sleep evaporated like alcohol on a summer sidewalk. Adrenaline slowed the world. She lay still and listened. She could hear her mother's breathing, smell smoke from the dying fire, wood fire. Smoke, and see only shadows on the wall. Carefully, she pulled herself away from Tabitha and looked toward the door. The streetlight glow was interrupted by a figure as someone crossed in front of the window outside. Russ a little, she thought. He's out there with his friends. Greg Finlay drove them here. They're going to kill us. Burn our house down. It's happening again. She saw a flash of light and then the unmistakable piquant smell of sulfur from a burning flare. Could she smell gasoline? Mama, she whispered. Mama, get up. There are people here. They're going to kill us. Mama, we have to run. Tabitha blinked her eyes. She saw the flickering red lights dancing on the curtain and asked, what time is it, Cupcake? I don't know, she said. It's late. We've got to go. Take the blanket. Crouching and silent, Eleanor hurried to the back of the house to see if it was guarded. It's midnight, her mom said, standing up, stretching and wrapping herself with a blanket, but making no move to follow Eleanor out the back door. Come on, Mama, Eleanor pleaded, her voice panicked and breaking. We have to go now. The doorbell rang. Eleanor, get the door. Mama, beseeched Eleanor. Tabitha, come now. Real terror gripped her. She could only gape as her mother just stood there, waiting, expecting Eleanor to get the door. Instinct, life, survival. She took a step back into the kitchen. This was it. It was over. She would run. She would figure out this mystery somewhere else, somewhere safe. And she would mourn, but she would live. She would miss Tabitha, miss David, miss it all. But she had to run. She looked again at her mother in a sad, horrible farewell. Tabitha grinned. She was mad. She didn't know what was coming. How could she? Eleanor crept farther away. Tabitha's grin melted into concern. Was she beginning to understand? Did she finally recognize the danger they were in? Why did she not run while she still could? Come, Mama! Eleanor said, shifting her weight for a leap. She turned to flee. She could wait no longer. Eleanor, no! Her mother said, it's all right. Ready to spring, knowing she could use the window over the sink if she had to, Eleanor paused. Trust me, her mother said. The words failed her. She stumbled. The bell rang again. The red, flaming lights cast bloody shadows through the drapes. She was scared. She was confused. Instinct said run. Tabitha, her living mother, asked her to trust her and stay. She froze. Her body as taut as a coiled snake. Eleanor, Cupcake, her mother said, trust me and get the door. Disoriented and angry, confused by her own insane movement, Eleanor found herself easing back inside. She stepped toward her mother, who welcomed the step with a smile and a nod. Come on, child, she said. Answer the door. Against everything she felt, everything she knew that was happening against her own survival instinct, Eleanor walked to the door as if hypnotized. At the door, she smelled hell. Outside was cordite, gunpowder, sulfur, and paper, all burning outside the house. Why was she doing this? She would die now. Die because she had trusted Tabitha instead of her instincts. For love, she would die. She was insane. She opened the door. I love that passage.
Yeah.
Gets me every time. She dies that it's a terrible thing. That's all her legs ripped off and everything.
Really?
No. Spoiler. No, yeah. Eleanor's death there.
The series is over.
That's it.
The rest is just, what do they call that? Text filling?
That's it. It's just Ipsum.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Ipsum lorem, right.
They did so well that, hey, when you're there, you can just do it. So this first question is basically, it's a really short one.
Okay.
I'm joking.
short questions.
Yeah, I don't have short questions, and they're never leading. So as we discussed briefly before we did the podcast, and you're always in danger of anything you say before coming back up, you had a different life. Well, you had a full life before really committing to being a full-time writer.
Yeah.
And we look at the two sections that you read from the two different books. One, obviously, with this more political, everyday. Well, I would say political everyday, but political, strong, with a lot of strong rhetoric when it comes to the local politics, so on and so forth. And another one that is young adult with this really fast-paced, pathos-driven character and plot. You know. If you were to look back, and you can totally go a completely different direction if you'd like to, but all that life before sitting down to become a professional writer, could you think of different ways that life informed maybe the part of you that writes this heavily rhetorical prose versus the person that's able to dive into that other world with the YA, with some of the paranormal, so on and so forth? What part, I guess what I'm asking is, what parts of you lead to or inform any that different writer of each?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I've heard it said that you have enough personal experience by the time you're 20 for a lifetime worth of writing, but you probably don't know what it means until you're 40.
Yeah.
And so I mean, finding any excuse I can to justify my late start in this career, I'll take that any day of the week. The two books, I mean, I'm multiple genres, right? I debuted in horror. My bestseller is a young adult paranormal character study, breaks a lot of the rules. My the book of the year is a comedy, noir, and The Brand Demand was a therapy piece to get through the end of the Bush years, and I've worked it out since then. And so I bring it up now.
But now,
it's great. Yeah, I really want people to start reading it.
Next book,
But I found each of them. I mean, it depends. Like somebody came up to Van Gogh and said, "Hey, this Starry Night was really good. You can only do landscapes now." Sure. No one would ever think of that.
Yeah.
But for a writer, you're supposed to be pigeonholed, and agents have a hard time selling multiple genres. But I can't find myself I write what I like to read. Mm-hmm. I write what I want to read, and so I needed to get The Brand Demand out. It was my love letter to the Monkey Wrench Gang, Edward Abbey. Back in my day, that was kind of a big deal. I mean, the Monkey Wrench Gang, a group of environmentalists who fought to stop the Glen Canyon Dam, and it was a fun adventure. They would call them eco-terrorists now, or activists, depending on which side of the spectrum you're on. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what would that look like today?
Yeah.
Where is the active left to counteract all these rights? And so that's where I envisioned Galen Reed, the blackmailer, and his gang. And so it's an homage to that. But that book, even there, it starts out a little polemic, and that's why it's my most edited book. But by the time I realized that the true story lies in the personal. And so even in that book, there's a transition from the political landscape to the personal, and that is where it becomes reality and really sinks into him. It's one thing to have theoretical politics, theoretical morals, but to actually test them is something else. And that's where The Brand Demand comes out. on that one. With Eleanor, it was just a character study. Mm-hmm. It's just a character study. I wanted to get into young adult because, let's face it, young adults read, and they're powerful, voracious readers, and I wanted to get something there. But my background is a literary wonk. Required me that it has to be a little deeper. And that's probably the connecting tissue of all my books, is a literary thematic elements that I'm always trying to explore. And in Eleanor, I wanted the idea of, again, a low power center. I wanted, she's a young girl, a very poor young girl, mm-hmm. in a Western town. So in a patriarchal society where money is king, I couldn't get her any lower, except making her a minority, which kind of she is as well. Mm-hmm. So I wanted this figure to be the strongest person in the room and just didn't know it. So I explored the idea there, actually, of survival versus love and everything. Survival versus trust, survival versus versus hope, bullying. There's many different themes that are explored in this one, it was quite an experience. Both these books are early in my career, where there's so much pressure behind the writing that they just kind of flow out themselves. Mm-hmm. And Eleanor kind of just took over my whole life for about a year to get the whole trilogy out. And following her examples, and again, I have thematic elements in book two. There's religion versus science, for example. Mm-hmm. She has to wrestle between. But the idea that an apex predator hiding in plain sight always just turned me on.
Yeah.
And as a young adult, she is a young adult. She's young, and yet she's very old at the same time. Mm-hmm. If you've read the book, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, spoiler alert, maybe I shouldn't do that.
No.
No, I shouldn't do it. But it's a paranormal character study. It's a magical realism. It's not like, there is one unusual element that signifies the entire book. Mm-hmm. And that is, again, a metaphor. It's an idea of change.
Sure.
Whereas change, she is the ultimate changer, but it hurts. And it's hard to, and once she's into something, when she's changed, it's difficult to change out again. And so again, a metaphor for this time of life where you're just finding yourself and you're trying to be who you are. And she's just been very exciting. And then the book itself also came out of a certain love of certain women in my life, my grandmother particularly, mm-hmm. Who died of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so it's a love letter to the strong women in my life. And that's kind of where that was born from.
Yeah.
More recently, I've written books of more horror, which I have a book coming, which again, I was in a dark place. it's called What Immortal Hand. It's coming out in September. Mm-hmm. And it's an evaluation of, it's horror in more of a conceptual view. Mm-hmm. For a Western thinker, where we have a binary cosmos, good and evil, mm-hmm. the trinity of the Hindu faiths is unnerving,
right?
Because there is no evil within that. It's mm-hmm. It's an example. I explore the
we don't know how to digest it, really.
No, we don't. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's there is evil in Hinduism. There are mm-hmm. demons, sure. running around. Trust me, there's plenty of these. But this book is about Kali. Mm-hmm. Kali is a consort of Shiva. Shiva is the part of the trinity that's responsible for destruction. There is Brahma and get this right, Vishnu, and Shiva, the creator, the sustainer, and the destroyer. And all of them are in ascension at any given time. It's a wheel of life.
Yeah.
And the story of Kali, which is just a beautiful metaphor, was that Shiva ran into demons he could not defeat, and he wept. And when he wept, his tears came out in a black bile. And his consort, I forgot her name at the moment, but she drank the bitter tears, mm-hmm. and it turned her black into Kali. Mm-hmm. And she slayed the demons. And she got into a bloodlust that could not be stopped. The demons could not stop her. Mankind could not stop her. Mm-hmm. The gods could not stop her, mm-hmm. from a bloodlust. And the famous picture of Kali shows her stepping over Shiva, because in order to stop her rampaging bloodlust, Shiva threw himself prostrate to her feet, just mm-hmm. to get that last little bit of love to stop her. So the idea of this book is... the destruction, the coming destruction. This is the large picture.
Yeah.
The coming destruction. And it's actually based around the idea also of the thugs in India. It's a class of criminals. You're born into a class of criminals. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Right.
So, but
and you're not moving. You're staying.
You're
right?
There. You're a thug. and your job is you kill people on the road, you bury their bodies, you steal their stuff. Uh-huh. You know, Kalima, Kalima.
Right.
Those are the thugs.
Right.
So the thugs were
that's
a real
really
thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I imagined them what they would look like in America. And that was the genesis of the story. And while I was writing it, I honestly just got so into the character and everything. I think I went insane. I'm really looking forward to the book coming out. It's coming out from OG. We're having a cover reveal at Stoker Con next month, which
Excellent.
Is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Make sure and remind us of the details, at the end of the podcast too.
Lots of details. Yeah. But again, it's what you're in the mood for. Now I'm writing a science fiction sociology trilogy. So
absolutely.
I don't know. It's science fiction's a whole different thing.
Oh, absolutely. With world building and I mean, like you, I've weaved between genres, nonfiction and essay and research and novels and so on. And even within novels, I've done different genres, different age groups. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting. You know, that's really exciting. And I was going to ask you too, like you read the passage from Eleanor, and I've got my notes and I'll probably never use them.
Okay.
you read the passage from Eleanor and you said, I love that scene. That scene gets me every time. And I actually did put it in my notes briefly as a question that when you're there, because you're spending 6 months writing a book.
On a bad book, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes they fight me.
To look at the book now and say, I love that passage. Do you have moments like that when you're crafting or like a passage like that? I mean, did you get that same rush when you wrote that passage?
I did, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. The most powerful, I mean, this is a very emotional book. This was mm-hmm. very raw. The same kind of thing that happened in Hand when I was really getting into the deep, dark illness. I was suicidal.
Yeah.
But with Eleanor, as I'm trying to explore these things, I mean, sometimes when I'm writing, I don't write well with others, but not just like with editing.
Yeah.
But just like because I tend to read out loud when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And I remember acting the scene out as it was happening, recognizing what it was, how Ellen would react to it. There's a couple of scenes in this. There's another one. There are a couple of them, actually, usually between these two characters, Tabitha, the mother, and Eleanor, where there's just an emotional gravitas that just gets me. The story was, I was reading the book after it was right before its launch. I'm in a restaurant reading it to find a passage, and I'm bawling at my own damn book.
Yeah.
Because it just gets me. And that's, you know, it was just a small moment.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, you walk away and you go, but
there are some that it gets me, but usually it's when you've got it, when the muse is there.
Yeah.
You feel it.
That's a question. You know, I always want to know that from other writers, you know, like, I mean, cause obviously there are things that you look back and you think, or you read it and you're like, I don't even remember writing that, you know, not because of intoxication or anything, just because you write
that
so much,
too.
but you write so much and you think, where did that come from? I don't even remember that. And that, to me, those are the coolest moments. And but I love hearing how you were able to just get in that moment and you knew right then, like when you walked out of where you wrote that morning, that was a good scene, and cool.
That one I did. Not all of them happen that way. Mm-hmm. But I'm always, when going back to my old books, I mean, first of all, I always edit it now. I can't open the damn book without knowing the better writers.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm crossing.
Yeah.
What I read had a couple of adverbs removed when I read it.
Yeah.
From the book. But there was, I'm sorry.
Same thing. Better, yeah.
I'm much as less as more now. Even though I can't write my name in under a page and a half, I still write long damn books.
Right.
But I find that, you know, I need the words. But sometimes I pick up books that I've written and I'm not sure how I feel about them, and then read them again. I said, I like these.
Yeah.
Because ultimately I'm writing them for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my motto on my website and my life is I write what I want to read. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not writing them for myself, if I don't enjoy them, who else will?
Yeah.
So they've got to at least push my buttons. I get asked the question, who's your favorite writer? And I say me.
Yeah.
Because this guy is like catering to everything I like.
Yeah. You know, he channels my favorite topics every day.
I have a question on that though. That being said, the more you publish, does it seep into your consciousness that I should probably write something this certain way because I will be easier to sell or anything or more commercial? Like, how do you stop those thoughts from entering your brain and keep to you and what you like?
Well, the best success I've had with that is no success. I'm sure that one day one of my books will hit some level of national attention.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Right.
And when that happens, I'm sure I'll be targeted, I'll be pigeonholed then. I mean, I often say writers are all prostitutes just looking for the best pimp, mm-hmm. right? And so once that happens, I'm sure I'll do it. But in the meantime, my lack of success and my curiosity has kept me going in all these different directions.
Yeah.
The Coronimes trilogy, which is the book that's taking longer than 6 months, is a good example. I mean, this thing won't even be ready to publish till 2018.
Yeah.
If then. And so in the meantime, I have 15 other novels, only 7 of which have seen paper.
Right, absolutely.
So I have a bit of a slowdown. But eventually something will happen. I've been asked about the fourth book in the Unseen series, but once my publisher gives me an advance, I'm sure we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we'll
Jollyfish. I have a plan. The book is called Wendy.
Yeah.
Anyway, for those of you who know it. But yeah, it's I'd like to be in that position where I have to, first world problems, right?
You know. You've never dropped a word or added a word thinking of somebody else or someone you might read it?
No, not really. I curtail my F-bombs in my young adult, mm-hmm. but I consider all my young adults to be adult books just with a younger protagonist. I get into the young adult mindset, and I think that's the primary thing you need to do for a young adult
book,
a young adult protagonist, young adult mindset. And the mindset is just one of compounding change, mm-hmm. of compounding challenges. This is the moment of definition. This is the moment of freedom when the mistakes that you make become your own.
Right.
And with that in mind, and you know, I address these issues. Eleanor, who's coming to terms with who she is, trying to realize what she is, mm-hmm. as long as who she is a good example of that. My other young adults that are coming out, there's one called Things Bequeathed, mm-hmm. which is my emotional follow-up to Eleanor about a young girl who has a familiar come visit her, a little mm-hmm. red, a 9-inch tall red devil, uh-huh. with an 18-inch wingspan, black fangs, pointed tail, the whole 9 yards. And she has to figure out what that's about. This ultimately becomes Johnny's book about daddy issues.
Uh-huh.
And this is where I express my problems. Sure. And so I use books for therapy. And if I can get a good story out of it, hallelujah.
You know? Oh, absolutely. I'm with you that way. And I think that's what, going back to the very first question we get started, which is great. And I'm glad we're not going to get to my other ones. because that means it's a good discussion, doesn't it? The book I'm writing right now is about how I was obsessed with my high school girlfriend. It's of course a novel, but
of course,
but you know, there's no real true elements in this book. But it's about a ghost at the local high school that sits on the hill up here and has nothing to do with my life. But you're right. It's there. It's like, where do we explore? And I think what you talked about earlier was really interesting, where this moment of transformation in young adulthood. And I really like how you pointed out that to write young adult, you have to be in their mindset, and this idea that everything is dramatic. And it's not, and I'm not saying that in a punitive way. I'm saying that if you remember back, and that's really funny because the book that I'm writing now is when I was in high school, and everything was important.
It was.
And you got to give that to young adults. That's the point in their life where it is. We as adults now, you know, things happen and we say, oh, well, that's too bad, but I bench it. But as a young adult, you have to recognize and not put them in a corner of you're just immature.
Right.
It's not immaturity. Mm-hmm. It's where they are in life. And I love how you said, well, and I think that's what you're saying is, adults will love it too, because it's, give me a time in your life that's not transformative. They can look back and say, ah.
Yeah, I say what an adult would go through, what we would call a midlife crisis, mm-hmm. a young adult would call a Tuesday.
Exactly.
And that's just it. And I see there are some young adults that really pander and are dumbed down or don't have any meat to them.
Yeah.
And those are nice little margarita mixers. But, right. I always try to do more literary in my elements. And so, that might be a problem, is it's difficult to sell, because I've found it's those kind of things aren't necessarily valued. I mean, it's fast food outsells health food.
It does,
still to this day.
Well, it's a lot harder to get into the health food
than
but once you're in, you know, it's so much
better.
But I think you're completely right, where there is that mix between young adult and adult, more mm-hmm. adult themes, mm-hmm. and you're giving those characters so much depth that you're giving them credit for who they are at that age. And that's hard to sell.
It really is. It is hard, because I mean the magic you get is once you get their trust, they'll follow you. And that was one of the downsides of Eleanor. Eleanor is a slow burn to begin with. I mean, it's not the 3-act structure. Mm-hmm. You can't pigeonhole that. I was talking to a movie producer about it the other mm-hmm. day, and he said, "Well, who's the antagonist? Who's the bad guy?" And I had my jaw dropped. I got nothing.
Yeah.
I got no, you know, the world, the universe, her mm-hmm. own inner demons, whatever. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work that way. And so the enduring criticism I get from that book is, well, it's a little slow to begin with. And yet, these same people will say when the moments happen that they're devastated. They cry and they say never anything like it. And I don't think there's a, I think there's a correlation there. I think by spending the time to lay the foundation for what happens later, it pays off.
Yeah.
It's not the immediate, oh, look, a Michael Bay explosion. Let's get into this. Exactly. Woo. I mean, the hook and everything. Instead, I got seven chapters. I don't know, like 50, 40 pages. If you're willing to give me this much, I'll make it worth your while. And that's why, my goal is to be so appreciated by my audience that they will let me try some more of these experimental books.
Yeah.
Because I love the experiment. I love what the media can do.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm, you know, to compete with video games is a tough thing to begin with. And so I tend to have a little more depth to these things. I mean, like in Things Bequeathed, it was, it follows the hero's journey. I have, I deliberately, consciously, because of my background, I studied criticism. I'm a deconstructionist. I speak Lacan,
right.
You know, and I deliberately put in, as she goes through her quest to find this, the four cardinal virtues of temperance, prudence, fortitude, and justice. And she's tested by each of these, represented by her four fathers, baby mamas.
Sure.
Which I thought was a marvelously clever idea. That was the kind of thing that, like all my books, can be taught effectively in an English class, which is hardly something that people want to hear when they're buying a book.
Right.
You just want to say it's a ripping good tale about a little demon. Yeah. It's Huck Finn meets How to Train Your Dragon. You're going to love it. Look for it soon from Scribner.
Yeah, I could just see a blurb. You know? Great for deconstructionalism.
Oh, God, no, right? I'm too
that sells, you know?
I know, right? It can't do it. Can't do it. So,
yeah.
But that's where I target. That's how I start. So it's for me. You got to pick. You know, you got to sell the sizzle and not the steak. And so I know the steak and not the sizzle. So that's why I have my agents and I are trying to get me to sizzle more. Sizzle.
Yeah.
Sizzle. Anyway. Yeah. So there's that. But the young adult, got to love the young adults though, because they're the ones. Well, I think maybe there's a real youth cult in America. It has been for a long time, right? The movies tend to be all based, targeted for the young adults. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you find an adult movie that slips out and some heavy emotional themes or something. The Revenant was, you know, but that's DiCaprio that did that.
Right.
If that would have been, you know, Adam Sandler, we would be talking about it. Well, it would have been a totally different movie. Yeah. People would have been cheering the bear.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, though, it really... If
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Adam, if you're listening to this, that was a cheap shot.
But it follows exactly what you're talking about, though. It's emblematic of it. Just DiCaprio is the sizzle and the steak. Because if you think about it, DiCaprio had those sizzle movies for about 10 years of his career where he was just beautiful, or he was just the guy that was in the teenage romance or something. But once he got people to follow him and invest... Now he's making movies like The Revenant, where they're going to go in. They know it might take some time to get to the stake, but they're
important movies like The Wolf of Wall Street.
Right, exactly.
Very important movie.
Mm-hmm.
Gilbert Grape was pretty steak.
That was
pretty steak. Yeah, he's got a little bit of integrity that a lot of other actors don't. You know, I don't know. It's tough because this is still a business.
Yeah.
And the literary market's hard. It's hard to break into as anything. And you know, I don't know. I think my writing is good enough to be read. So far, so good, but it's still tricky because I keep, you know, finding new audiences, and it's publisher perish still, at this stage. So I don't know. It's, I mean, like I say, we're all prostitutes looking for the best pimp. If the finger trap gets picked up big and the series gets going, I will write a Tony Flanner every year for the rest of my life. And they're still thematic, but it's not the meat you might get out of a What a Mortal Hand or Brandeman, which is, you know, Brandeman's just a good romp too, but it won't be the same.
Yeah.
Which, absolutely. God, first world problems right there. Right?
No, I know. I mean, that's a problem that we all want, isn't it?
Well, like Janet Ivanovich here, she's, sorry, Janet, you've written the same book for the last 20 years. And, you know, and she's still moving them out.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's Patterson, he doesn't write his books.
Well, Patterson, oh, God, I know. It's like the best title. Here's the joke. I was talking about The Sausage Party. If any of you saw that movie, I'm sorry. I had nothing to do with it. But the joke is a great title for a movie, The Sausage Party, starring Brad Pitt. That's a great title. Sausage Party, no. But starring Brad Pitt on top of anything. And that's why, you know, you can see a book that says James Patterson, and that you don't even know what the title is. All you know is the James Patterson. Yeah. So it's a known commodity, and you're right, he isn't writing his own anymore. Gosh, I'm dissing all my peers. Sorry, guys. We all know this, right? That he's co-writing a lot of these books now, right?
This is well known.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, guys, if you knew that.
He has a quorum of the 75 right in his book.
Yeah, quorum of the 75. That's good. But it's, you know, but writing is still so, it's, you know, there was once I once wrote a great blog post on this. It's just an idea that if you think you're a writer, don't think you're a writer. Quit. Don't do this.
Yeah.
Do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Go flip burgers. Go become an architect.
Yeah.
Wash cars. Do that. Do anything but this. If you can't not do this, you might be a writer.
Right. Exactly. You know? And so if you can't go your days.
Yeah. If you've got,
if you feel three days without writing and you feel like shit,
yeah,
there's nothing else in the world that's going to make you feel a little bit better.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
That's it.
That's it. You know, and 3 days is probably my limit, you know, and I don't know.
I went five. My computer's crashed. It's killing me now though.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of like the whole mentoring thing. So knowing that they're the financial rewards of being an artist in any kind of any kind, whether it's a written word or you're sculpting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your chances are slim. Same. So you find recompense in other ways. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, first of all, if you define yourself by money, you're shallow anyway. Yeah. But writing and artistry has the opportunity to mentor and to explore the craft with other people. And this is like where the League of Utah Writers segue comes in.
Yeah.
And that is rewarding
it
to
is.
Talk about people who've had the same like you case, you know, since trying to get published, the eddies we're in, waiting for somebody to notice our brilliance, and it's hell, it's hard, and it's emotional. I mean, the rejection involved in any kind of artistic endeavors is not to be underestimated.
Yeah,
and so just having other people you can commiserate with is just wonderful.
It is.
You know, it's just get, you know, somebody to drink with.
We need a community.
Welcome to Literally Podcast. Yeah,
this is the truth. I mean, and I think the hard part too is getting a bite of success. A little success is even harder. Like it's the little bit and you're like, oh, this next one's going to break. So good. And then you've got, then you're on submission.
Yeah. It's always a tough one.
And people, they get angry at you. Like, well, you've had some success, you know, you're well published. And you're like, yeah, but I'm still frustrated as hell. And they're like, yeah, but you know,
I'm not where I'm at yet.
Yeah, I know. It's not it. It's still, you're not, it's just a deeper level of hell. And so
I remember I was at a Comic-Con and, you know, all the writers get access to the same green room because nobody cares about us. And so no, we're not being followed by a bunch of people. Like, they'll feed us in the corner, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember, who wrote the Dresden Files? Look it up up front. But anyway, all its local writers are there. And, you know, it's a zero-sum game, right?
Yeah.
Where your writers can be my writers. My readers can be your readers, so we can all play together, right?
Sure.
We're not in competition, except we're a bunch of shallow, you know, and so we're all envious of each other's success. You got a hardcover, nice. Oh,
beautiful.
Knopf, nice. Yeah, I'm self-publishing still. So all that kind of thing happens. But I remember some of the people that I have just, Jim Butcher was at Comic-Con, and I remember I had a booth, and Jim Butcher was coming for a signing. Jim Butcher wrote the Dresden Files, and his line extended all around. It was the longest line I've ever seen for a signing, and that includes Brandon Sanderson, who rules the state, who's awesome. He deserves it, by the way. But I watched this line that snaked around across my booth, and I'm trying to sell books to these people. As good as his, take this.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I remember the people that I really envied, and I noticed how I feel when I see somebody above me, and they were envying him. Mm-hmm. So I said, it never goes away, does it? I asked a couple and said, Oh no! There's always something we can do. Our sales could always be better. We're always looking over our shoulder, which is terrifying. So I'm wondering if Dresden's, if Butcher's looking over his shoulder, going, you know, that Stephen King's got that it coming out. You know,
that guy can't do anything wrong.
I know, right?
Geez, it's been out for 40 years.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. Well, this is Case Johnson. It's the Literally Podcast. Today, our guest was Johnny Worthen. We're at Booked 25th. On 25th on Historic 25th Street. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much. We hope to have you get back again when your next book comes out. Does that sound like a good idea?
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
That would be a lot of fun. This is good. I didn't look at my notes. So that means that was a great cast. Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Brandon, awesome. Thank you.
That's it.